Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Coming up after the news, it's Philosophy Talk.
Our topic today is freedom of speech in times of war.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, John.
Well, that's what the Constitution says, but the government doesn't always say the same thing. Witness the Sedition Act of 1798. The Espionage Act of 1917, or the Patriot Act of our own present time.
But the Constitution doesn't say free speech except during wartime.
But Ken, speaking out against a war can give aid and comfort to the enemy and can undermine our national unity.
And it can also help end a misbegotten misadventure launched on the basis of imperial fantasies and outright lies, John.
Well, there is that. Free speech in times of war, to abridge or not to abridge? Our guest, Jeffrey Stone, will help us confront that question when Philosophy Talk continues after the news.
Each day, millions of people go to sleep hungry.
Hungry for new ideas, new approaches, new thinking, new philosophies.
But they have nowhere to turn.
That's where you, our audience, comes in. For a small donation to Philosophy Talk, you can help enlighten others.
For the cost of one cup of coffee per day, you can help keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
Go donate now at philosophytalk.org.
And help feed this hunger for thought. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local and innovative radio for San Francisco. And we'd like to welcome our new affiliates, KWMR in Point Reyes Station and KXRA in Monterey.
Yes, welcome to those affiliates. Our conversations begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, and they continue up here.
And then, from the air, they migrate to the blog via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out.
Our topic today is freedom of speech in times of war. And Ken, I think we should start with freedom of speech, and you can tell me what freedom is or what speech is. It's up to you.
I think I'll start with speech. You know, people like to distinguish. There's three things. There's thought, there's speech, there's action, right? Speech expresses my thoughts, and to the extent that I'm free to think my thoughts, one might think I should be free to express them. Speech, though, is different from action. When I speak, if I advocate, say, that George Bush be elected or that John Kerry be elected, I haven't elected John Perry, John Kerry. I haven't done anything to make that happen, right? So there's a difference between speech and action, but speech is connected to thought and the expression of thought.
Well, that clarifies a lot. I mean, one thing about thought, I mean, you can't hear or see other people's thoughts, but they have content. And that's what they share with the speech. The speech has content. It's that aspect of speech that's free. You're free to say whatever you think. Whatever you think the world is like or ought to be like, you should be free to say it. You're not free to say it as loudly as you want or wherever you want. It's that content that the freedom pertains to. So that leads us from speech to freedom. What exactly is free about this expression of content?
Well, I mean, there should subject to certain limits, I guess. I mean, I'm in a crowded theater, and I'm not free to say, the theater is on fire, right? I mean, because that's wrong, especially if I believe that falsely. If I believe it truly, I guess I should say it, right? But if I believe it falsely...
Well, You probably maybe still shouldn't say it, but that's for another show, the philosophy of pyromania or something. But the point is that the nasty thing about this, the thing that gets in the way of everything being simple, is that speech is a way of acting. You can express a thought, and that's supposed to be free. But by expressing a thought, you can do other things. You can incite people to violence, or you can give aid and comfort to the enemy.
For example, or think about something less controversial than aid and comfort to the enemy, just for a second, commercial speech, right? If I say, this is a great product, I'm trying to get you to do something. I have what philosophers call a perlocutionary intent. I'm trying to bring something else about by my speech. And the government can regulate it or not regulate it, depending upon its view about the thing I'm trying to bring about, right?
Well, so it seems. I mean, you can't say whatever you think if you're on TV and it's going to mislead a lot of people into buying a product that's dangerous for them. Does it follow that you shouldn't be able to say whatever you think if it's going to give aid and comfort to the enemy? That's what our governments have often thought.
Yeah, right. And to help us answer that question, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out and talked to some people who have close-up knowledge with this kind of question. She files this report.
This is a tale of two career soldiers. One, a major general who commanded the 1st Marine Division into Kuwait during Desert Storm. The other, a staff sergeant who manned a machine gun in the back of a Humvee while guarding the Baghdad airport.
My name is James Michael Might, and I'm a retired Marine Major General. I served in Vietnam two tours, 30 months, and I commanded the 1st Marine Division in the 1st Gulf War.
My name is Diana Morrison. I served with the 270th Military Police Company. I was mainly a gunner in Baghdad.
It's not as simple and straightforward to say, well, I have the right of free press today. It's more complicated than that. With the technology today, if somebody's protesting back here in the United States, we're aiding and abetting the cause because they find out about it that instant. We're dealing with this entity, which we call the insurgents, the terrorists. When they look back and they see big protest in San Francisco, big protest in London, big protest in New York, all on the same day, they kind of say, hey, I think we're winning.
One night when we were out, we got into a really bad ambush. We had something exploded near my vehicle, and then there were RPGs flying, and I fired some rounds from a grenade launcher and then from my machine gun, and I didn't see the kids die, but we just heard that we had killed two kids. After witnessing what I had witnessed, I thought, this is wrong, you know, and I was home, I was safe, I was alive. Someone called me and asked if I would help a filmmaker make a film. He said, hey, you ought to join Veterans for Peace. And I liked the name, and I went to a meeting, and I discovered that there were a lot of Vietnam veterans that felt the way I did, not only about the Vietnam War, but about this war. After I joined Veterans for Peace, I went to their national convention in Boston in the summer of 2004 and co-founded Iraq Veterans Against the War. All of us are speakers and we'll talk to the media, whatever, about our point of view.
In the technologically advanced era, the debate about dissent has to be conducted to talk about how in the heck do I disagree with what's going on and make it known to somebody that I disagree with what they're doing without endangering somebody else or causing them to have severe morale problems, because I think that is an issue for us. The last thing that we want to happen is for these great Americans who are volunteered to go off and be in harm's way feel like we're criticizing them because we disagree with a policy of what put them there. Wendy Sheehan can run around here and be protesting because she lost her son, but in many ways she's harming the good that some of the Americans are trying to do in Iraq.
When a soldier does go to war and they come back and say, well, this is what happened and I think this is wrong, what's going on is wrong, that's, I think, the most powerful form of dissent, because here is the person that you would expect would be no matter what gung-ho, and they're coming back and saying, whoa, there's definitely something wrong. I think it makes people think.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Two veterans with quite different ideas about freedom of speech in times of war, thanks to our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined now by Jeffrey Stone, who is a professor of law from the University of Chicago. He's author of a very fine book that I've been reading lately called Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. Jeff, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Delighted to be here.
Jeff, John Perry here. Before we start talking more about what free speech is and what puts strains on it, why don't you tell us why you think it's a good thing? Why should free speech be protected in a democratic society?
Well, there are several rationales for the protection of free speech as a constitutional matter, but the most important is that the whole notion of self-governance assumes that individual citizens will be free to hear all ideas and opinions and information that are relevant to enabling them to make wise decisions on matters of public policy, on who their leader should be, on what actions their government should take in their name. and that any law that essentially interferes with their ability to inform themselves about such matters directly undermines the very concept of self-governance. So free speech is really a corollary of the very concept of democracy and of the fact that we live in a society in which each individual citizen has the responsibility to participate in governance.
That sounds quite reasonable to me, Jeff. It sounds even that you might even... It even extends beyond democracy in a way, because if you think of each of us as self-governing, as an autonomous being, and free speech is, it sounds to me like it's a kind of aspect of self-governance and self-expression. I express myself to others, I offer them up reasons, I try to persuade them, and I should be able to, I mean, what kind of government, period, could legitimately override that, one might wonder.
Well, there is this question of whether free speech is a necessary ingredient of a thriving democracy, but is it sufficient? I mean, seems to me we have a fair amount of freedom of speech in America today, but we don't hear all opinions. I mean, we hear a lot of lunacy, and you have to be pretty aggressive to find all opinions.
I don't think that the idea of free speech is to insist upon all opinions being advocated. It's also based in part upon a distrust of government to be in the business of deciding which ideas can and cannot be presented. Government has, on the one hand, both the responsibility to the citizens, but on the other, government officials often have clear self-interest, partisan political interest, personal political interest, that can interfere with the extent to which they serve the public interest. And that conflict is probably most acute when it comes to regulating expression, and particularly political expression, because in that context, political officials clearly have the interest in getting themselves reelected and perpetuating their power.
Right.
So there's a combination of values here. Part of them is the notion of self-governance. Related to that is the idea that government is not, in fact, ever going to be a neutral arbiter of what are good or bad or safe or dangerous ideas to be expressed.
No, but sometimes, I mean, I don't know if... Sometimes, you know, the public, the people at large, have lots of bad ideas. Public debate is just a cacophony of noise often. And one might want some way of improving the character of public debate, of improving the marketplace of debate. Just like we regulate markets and other things in some ways, right? Why not regulate markets and speech to protect against the spread of pernicious, bad, evil ideas? I mean, why not?
Well, we do regulate the speech market to some degree in order to improve the overall market as a whole. So examples of that would have been, say, the Fairness Doctrine with respect to broadcasting, or campaign finance regulation, which are designed to improve the marketplace. But on the other hand, the notion of the government deciding that certain ideas are pernicious or unwise or immoral holds enormous danger. Because if the government can suppress the expression of particular ideas, then it essentially stops political and social debate. So it's easy to imagine, for instance, that if we did not have the First Amendment or did not have a culture that believed in the basic idea of a First Amendment, that there might have been laws, for example, that prohibited advocacy of the abolition of slavery, or laws that prohibited the advocacy of women's suffrage, or laws that prohibited the advocacy of equal rights for gays and lesbians in our society. There have certainly been moments in time when a vast majority of people would have said, those are terrible ideas, those are pernicious ideas, let's just shut them off before people begin to believe them. But the basic premise of the First Amendment is to trust the people themselves to hear those ideas and ultimately to decide, even if they make mistakes sometimes, what is right and what is wrong in that process of clashing ideas that are unregulated by the government.
I understand that we have freedom of speech. We think of most Western European countries as having some kind of freedom of speech, but the conceptions often vary. Let me throw three quick questions at you, because you're an expert and I'd like to know the answers. First of all, there's this issue of trials. I've heard it said that in Britain and other so-called civilized countries, they don't have freedom of speech to trot out all the opinions about trials that are coming up as we do. Second is slander. And the third is this idea I've heard from George Will over and over, so it must be right, but I can't quite believe it, that our doctrine of freedom of speech means you can't put limits on political contributions. What do you think of those three things?
Well, the first one, the question of information about trials, in the United States, trials are understood to be important governmental activities in which the rights and liberty of particular individuals is being determined by government agencies, courts. And therefore, there is a very strong presumption that what goes on in courts should be available and open to the public to the greatest extent possible. The Supreme Court has recognized that there can be circumstances where there are compelling interests involved, where it may be possible to close a judicial proceeding to the public, but it has to be only in those circumstances where there is a true necessity that would justify it.
Jeff, I'm going to ask you to hold up on the slander question for just a second.
Keep your slander to yourself for just a minute.
We'll come back to that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk today, Freedom of Speech in Times of War with Jeffrey Stone. We've been talking about what justifies and limits freedom of speech. In our next segment, we'll discuss why governments are so often tempted to abridge it during times of war.
You can add your voice to the mix by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
War, the urge to stifle dissent, and your calls when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Tom Tom Club and Wordy Rapping Hood. What a catchy tune. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing freedom of speech in times of war. Does dissent give aid and comfort to the enemy? Does it undermine national unity when unity is most needed? Should the government, therefore, attempt to stifle it? Join us. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. You can keep your name anonymous if you wish, if you're afraid of the Patriot Act, if you have opinions that you think somebody thinks is going to give aid and comfort to the enemy, just send them to us anyway.
Our guest is Jeffrey Stone from the University of Chicago. Jeff, before the break, you were about to answer John's question about slander, and if you give me a brief answer to that, I want to segue into our discussion about abridging free speech in times of war.
Sure. Well, there are certain types of expression that the Supreme Court has held do not themselves contribute in any positive way to public debate, and therefore are not entitled to the same degree of protection as most forms of speech. And false statements of fact are an example of a category that the court has said do not, in fact, add value to public discourse and therefore may be regulated in ways that other speech may not be regulated. And so slander or defamation or libel are all variants of the false statement of fact problem. And so the notion is I simply lie in a statement about another person and say so-and-so had an affair and it's not true, then I can be held responsible to that other person for making the false statement.
You know, that raises a question that kind of can help us get into what the government has done to abridge free speech in times of war. Because you might ask the question, well, if I can't lie about John, can I lie about political officials? Can I say, suppose it's not true that George Bush lied to get into the war, but I make it my campaign to convince people that he lied to get us into the war? I mean, can the government, I know the government has at times tried to stifle that kind of thing. That's the Sedition Act of 1798. But why don't you give us a brief history lesson first about the things the government has in fact done to try to abridge free speech in times of war?
Throughout American history, there has been, in times of war, a very strong pattern of government acting in ways that were later determined to have been excessive in their efforts to regulate expression during these crises. And this goes back right to the very beginning of the founding of the nation, less than a decade after the Constitution was amended to add the First Amendment. The Federalist Congress enacted legislation, the Sedition Act of 1798, which was enacted in the context of what was thought to be a pending war with France. And the Sedition Act made it effectively a crime for any person to criticize the president, the Congress, or the government of the United States. And the Republicans, led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, argued that that legislation was blatantly unconstitutional, clearly violated the promise that Congress would make no law abridging the freedom of speech. After all, what could more obviously, they argued, abridge the freedom of speech than a law making it a crime to criticize the president or the Congress? The Federalists, on the other hand, argued that in time of war, when national unity is essential, any speech that would cause citizens to have less confidence in the judgment and the wisdom of their elected officials would undermine the ability of the nation effectively to fight, to wage the war, and therefore must be restricted.
Now, Jeff, let me just question, check my facts here. Although this really wasn't during war, right? This was a run-up to a war with France that never occurred. So the Alien Sedition Act wasn't in times of war, but in times when war was threatening. Is
right.
That
it
fair?
Was clearly, yeah, that's not only fair, it's absolutely accurate. It was enacted in circumstances in which the Federalists claimed that there was inevitably going to be an imminent war with France, and this was necessary, just like building forts and building navy. This was necessary to prepare the nation for what they argued was an inevitable war. In fact, the war, of course, never happened.
But from reading your book, although the war never happened, and I was talking to somebody, and they said, "What war with France?" I said, "The one we almost." It was an intense time. The Federalists and the Republicans were intensely divided over this issue. If I get the sense, and the populace was intensely divided. There were all these people. It was kind of like the fear of communism in the 50s, the fear of Jacobinism in the 1790s. Am I getting that right?
No, I think you're exactly right. In fact, it's important to remember that we now take the United States government and the basic principles on which that government is based largely for granted. But in the 1790s, no one had created a nation with the kind of principles on which the United States government was then based. And it was clearly understood as an experiment and as a very uncertain experiment. And both the Federalists and the Republicans were quite uncertain as to whether this society, this new government, would survive. So we've learned over more than two centuries that we can weather some very difficult times. But they didn't know that at all in the 1790s.
But Jeff,
they thought the stakes were extremely high.
That should have been known by the 20th century, but in both World War I and World War II, particularly World War I, they were very serious abridgments of freedom of speech. Isn't that right?
You know, World War I was in many ways the most repressive period of American history with respect to free speech. Most people forget that World War I, unlike World War II, was not a particularly popular war. Wilson, remember, had been reelected in 1916 on the platform that he had kept us out of war. And when Wilson finally decided to enter the war, a large percentage of the American people were quite puzzled about why it was necessary to shed American blood in a conflict that seemed to involve no vital interest to the United States,
and rightly so.
What did the government do about this?
Feeling that there was a need to generate a sense of intense patriotism, because if you want to make the people make the sacrifices that are necessary to fight a war effectively, they have to believe in the war. Wilson basically adopted a two-prong approach. First, he created something called the Committee on Public Information, which was essentially a propaganda arm of the executive branch, which was charged with the responsibility of creating a flood of newspaper articles, editorials, speeches, movies, all of which were designed to generate a hatred of all things German and a deep suspicion of anyone who may have had doubts about the legitimacy of the war.
And these weren't just published in Iraqi papers. These were published in American papers. Yeah.
These were published in American papers. And then the second thing that Wilson did was to, in order to suppress all of the criticism of the draft and the war, he got through Congress the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, which again effectively made it a criminal offense in the United States for any person to criticize the draft, the war, the president, the Congress, the government, the flag, the Constitution, the military, United States.
So the government goes berserk often in times of war. It just goes berserk. We've got a caller on the line, John in San Francisco, who wants to join this conversation. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Hello. Love your show. I wanted to say that if people don't dissent, if they don't express their dissatisfaction with their government, then eventually, if you don't complain, you'll lose your right to even speak out. And I think that it's the responsibility of every good citizen to dissent if they feel that their government is steering the ship of state awry. And I really think that this administration, with its great transparencies and, I believe, kind of phony motives for this war, it's our responsibility to speak out against that.
Thanks, John. That's a good point. Jeff, look, you seem to be a great advocate of free speech. And you said about a lot of these decisions made at the time that they were later recognized as having been excessive. But I want to challenge both you and the caller. I'm going to put the line, look, we're at war. That's a moment of great national peril. I mean, your book is In Perilous Times, right? And in perilous times, maybe you have to take extreme measures. Maybe ordinarily it would be wrong to stifle dissent in this way. But when you're facing an enemy and national survival is at risk, I mean, what's wrong with trying to say we have to give up something that we ordinarily would not want to give up?
Well, it's certainly not irrational to believe that in time of war, free speech, particularly dissent to the war, can be harmful to American interest, as the Major General said in your piece from The Roving Philosopher. It is, in fact, the case that dissent in wartime in the United States that is designed to participate in public decision-making here can indeed, may have the effect of demoralizing our troops and strengthening the resolve of the enemy. So it's not as if dissent in wartime is harmless. But of course, if speech was harmless, there'd be no need to protect it. What it really is saying is that you cannot have a democracy, you cannot have a self-governing society, and you cannot have sound decision-making in the absence of freedom to talk about and to disagree over fundamental issues of national policy. So the argument is not that speech is harmless. Mm-hmm. It's that it is fundamentally important, and if you don't have it, then not only will you not make good decisions, not only will your citizens not be able to participate effectively in public decision-making, but in fact, the ability of the nation to act wisely will be hampered. And so it actually interferes with the ability to make national policy well, including fighting a war successfully.
415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Yes, join us. Give us a call. Now, Jeff, when Ken posed these questions, he says it might be necessary to abridge the ordinary freedoms. But the way the word war is being used now, it's going to go on forever. Is there a precedent for this? I mean, during the period when Native Americans were constantly being subdued by our armies in the territories, We didn't officially call it a war. Was there an idea that the whole thing counts as a war, the war against Indians or something?
Or take the Cold War, which was an
ongoing. The Cold War?
Yeah. I mean,
the Cold War is probably the best analogy because, of course, now we know the Cold War ended. But during the Cold War, nobody had any reason to believe it was ever going to end. I mean, there was no light at the end of that tunnel. And so in that sense, this is not unprecedented. But I do think that the important point about the notion of a war going on forever is that it strongly cuts against what should be our willingness to accept restrictions on civil liberties. Because one of the arguments made in favor of limiting rights in wartime is that at least it's a temporary measure. At least it's a measure that will end after a year or two or three, and we may need to suspend these liberties for a short period of time in order to accomplish a specific and immediate end. Whether that's right or wrong, it obviously changes the stakes entirely if we believe we are involved in a perpetual state of war.
Michael,
in which case, we're not just temporarily compromising our rights, we're giving them up forever.
Michael in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yeah, I was about to actually make the same point that they've been bringing up this idea of the state of exception, and the state of exception is now becoming permanent. It happened with the Cold War. You had the exceptionalism of a war that lasted, you know, from all the way up to the end of the 80s after World War II. And there's also the idea of American exceptionalism, that, you know, the United States is somehow by its nature different from every other state. So when we do things that are, you know, wrong, like torturing prisoners or whatever, that it's because we're exceptional, and somehow since we're doing it, it must be okay.
Thanks, Michael. Paul in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I have a couple quick comments. One is that, you know, you'd been talking about the UK earlier, and the UK does not have any right for free speech embodied in constitution the way that we do. And I think that's a key difference between the UK and the US. And, you know, you can see that play out in the differences in free speech that they have, you know, in that country compared to the US. So I think comparing the US to the UK can be kind of dangerous for that reason. I'd like to also talk about the general that was you guys interviewed at the the roving philosopher spot at the beginning, and that argument that you were kind of talking about a minute ago. The idea that, you know, there has been this fundamental new, you know, change, this new condition that somehow trumps free speech, you know, the internet, the war on terror. And, you know, it seems to me that you know, in response to something like 9/11, which all this, you know, has sort of come out, in, you know, as a response to, you know, there are two main choices, or, you know, a choice between two big alternatives. One is the way that Spain, for example, responded to the Madrid bombings, where the Spanish monarch came forward and said, you know, in this crisis, we have to, you know, show the best of our country and not respond, you know, in kind or, you know, by, you know, sort of doing the very thing.
So what's the other approach?
You know, and the other approach is the approach that our country took after 9/11, which is that, you know, this is this, you know, fundamental change in the nature of things such that we have to, you know, roll back civil rights, roll back free speech, you know, and all of that. And so my question for your guest is, you know, is that a good argument at all?
Thanks, Paul. Jeff, there's lots of things between Paul and Michael, the previous caller. Pick out what you want to respond to there.
Well, the point about the internet is an interesting one, because every time a new means of communication has been invented, whether it be the printing press or radio or movies or television or now the internet, the claim has been made that this is a very dangerous new device, and it must be subject to regulation in a way that prior means of communication were not regulated. So when the printing press was invented, the English government immediately went into licensing, saying no one can publish anything without having a prior license from the government. And interestingly, when movies were invented, the same arguments were made. These are much more powerful forms of communication. We can't trust people to see them without the government screening them to make sure they're appropriate. When radio and television came into existence, Congress enacted the Fairness Doctrine and all the regulations that allow the government to decide
Jeff, though, I mean, so if we were in sort of ancient times where news traveled abroad really, really slowly, some runner had to take the thing, you know. But in the age of instant communication, I mean, don't citizens owe some obligation to understand that their words, although addressed to their fellow citizens, echo around the world? I mean, the uptake is all over the world. I mean, there is a point to that. It's not just irrational to say that people are listening in, so guard your words carefully.
Well, I don't know. Most people, most of the time, think that what they're saying is true and wise, and that it'd be good if people all over the world listened. During the Vietnam War, which I remember quite well, of course, if you were opposed to the war, you felt bad that you were definitely giving aid and comfort to the enemy. But you also thought about those lives, both the enemies and the soldiers, that would be lost if this thing continued forever and ever. It seems to me the great thing about the internet is that this kind of pious hope that you've always had, you know, the truth will out. Actually, most of the time, truth doesn't out. But the more voices we've got, as we now have on the internet, the better chance that pious hope will actually come to fruition.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing freedom of speech with Jeffrey Stone, author of Perilous Times.
We've been talking about freedom of speech during times of war, drawing on examples from our history. Coming up, we'll focus on dissent, the government, and the press in the context of the Iraq War and the alleged war on terrorism.
Dissent, Iraq, the contemporary media, and more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
My time is too expensive, and I'm not your little boy.
Aaron Neville, tell it like it is. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk.
And I'm Ken Taylor. With us is Jeffrey Stone from the University of Chicago. We're discussing freedom of speech during times of war. Let's go to the contemporary context. To what extent is the Patriot Act and today's concerns about dissent a good or a bad thing? Tell us what you think. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us from anywhere around the world, Iraq, Paris, wherever you happen to be, comments at philosophytalk.org.
Jeff, I want to just go back to what John was saying at the very end of the last segment. Again, I think people are listening in, right? I agree, the unfettered exercise of ideas, but the marketplace of ideas is a mess. And to let the marketplace of ideas on its own sort out the truth, I mean, we may have lost the war by then, right? If we let dissent go unfettered. I mean, people are listening. We do. John almost said, we do, by dissent, give aid and comfort to the enemy. And how could we, wouldn't it be arrogant of us to believe that our mere opinion is going to persuade the populace to stop supporting this war and end this thing? So it seems to me complicated.
Indeed, one of the great concerns that underlies much of judicial doctrine about free speech is exactly the point you just made. That is, each of us knows that our own contribution to that marketplace of ideas, whether it's signing a petition or marching in a demonstration or writing an email or a blog, is unlikely to have any significant impact on the overall outcome of American policy. And therefore, if there is any fear that one will be disadvantaged by as a result of having expressed one's view, then people often will say, well, you know, I think I'll take a pass on this. Instead of signing that petition that opposes the war in Iraq, if I believe that my signing that petition may get me in trouble somewhere down the road, then I am likely to forego signing that petition. And the problem is, if not only one person, but a million people or several million people all individually make that same decision, then the net effect is to totally corrupt public discourse and the opinions in the community. And that's one of the critical factors about chilling effect in First Amendment law.
I see your point. Let's go to the current context. One of our callers said something like this. The current situation, the war in Iraq and the war on terrorism, well, the Bush administration frames this situation as a war on terrorism, a global war on terrorism, and they frame Iraq as the first front in that war. Do you see any dangers in the mere framing to freedom of speech, in the mere framing of it that way?
Well, sure. I mean, the reason for framing it, of course, is both rhetorical and legal. Part of it is to enable the executive branch to assert the powers and the authorities that ordinarily can be exercised only in a wartime environment. And that has both the emotional impact on the public to think of the United States being at war, and it also enables the government to demand special authority. And, for example, the passage of the Patriot Act was certainly tied up with the notion that not only the United States had been attacked, but that these exceptional measures were necessary because this was not merely a criminal act, but because this was, in effect, the equivalent of Pearl Harbor. This was the attack on the sovereign nation of the United States by a enemy of the United States, and we needed to respond in a way, both internationally and domestically, as if we are at war.
Right. Lynn in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lynn.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, you know, I'd be interested more in how gray or what are the parameters of the Sedition Act? You know, at what point does it become real? I grew up in Nebraska in the 50s, which my mother fled after she headed up the Rosenberg's Defense Committee. And I grew up, you know, with fear that was just, in fact, the best record of my childhood is my mother's FBI file, which I got. So I've never had a sense that, in fact, people are really free to speak their mind.
So, Lynn, where in Nebraska did you grow up?
Well, I lived in Omaha.
Omaha, okay. Well, down in Lincoln, we thought Omaha was a beacon of free speech and cosmopolitan values.
Well, there was a big, you know, my mother was part of the civil rights movement. My grandfather was a farmer where she grew up. And in 1944, she ran for the Board of Education on an integration and child care ticket. But, you know, my father was persecuted in his work. My friends, you know, parents called us communists. I mean, she paid a very, very dear price for the political work that she did in Omaha. And in fact, people may not know here in San Francisco, but
yeah, let me follow up a little on Lynn's idea here, which, as I hear it, is that, you know, maybe the government is not so active about putting people in jail, but freedom of speech can suffer in other ways. Just the intolerance of a community, the unwillingness of people to listen, things that people do. And to me, right now, I don't much like the Patriot Act, but if you look at why we're in the dilemma we're in, it mainly seems to me it's because the Democrats in Congress were cowed when the Iraqi war started. Well, and how would freedom of, they were clearly free to say what they thought, but they didn't. What do we do about that?
Let me just add really quickly, Jeff, that, and Lynn suggested that it's an ongoing thing throughout her life. It's not just some exceptional thing that the government occasionally goes haywire or freedom of speech is occasionally threatened. It's kind of a constant thing, she seemed to be suggesting.
Free speech or the First Amendment are not a panacea. They don't solve all of a nation's problems. They give the citizens, or they have the potential at least, to give the citizens the power to contribute to the solution of problems. If individuals are intimidated into not exercising their right to free speech, whether by the government or by other citizens, if citizens choose not to understand the importance of respecting their fellow citizens when they disagree with them and too quickly equate dissent with disloyalty, then free speech is not going to be a solution. It is simply a device that helps self-governance, that helps democracy achieve its goals in a better rather than a worse way. And so part of what's necessary, and I think has been lacking for a very long period of time, is a kind of educational, national educational effort in understanding why we have the liberties we do, why that the speech, the ideas, the views of others, even if we disagree with them, should be respected and indeed listened to rather than dismissed out of hand, why it's important to hear disagreement. And all of that is built into the culture of a self-governing society.
Right.
And it's learned. It's not there naturally. And it's something that I think foundations and educational institutions and the media and government officials all need to contribute to so that American citizens understand that as citizens of a self-governing society, they have responsibilities. And those responsibilities are both to contribute their ideas and also to listen to the ideas of others.
Yeah, Jeff, I think you're right. And I wish, I mean, we've just scratched the surface of this topic. Unfortunately, there's lots more to say, but I'm going to have to say goodbye to you and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Our guest has been Jeffrey Stone, professor of law at the University of Chicago, author of Perilous Times, Free Speech and Wartime from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism. I've been reading this book. I'm in the middle of it. I highly recommend it. It's an eye-opening book.
And we also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to.
So, John, what do you think today? And you're free to express what you think here.
Well, thanks. Well, I'm a big advocate of freedom of speech. On the other hand, I think it's a necessary condition, but what we need to recognize is it's a far from a sufficient condition for a thriving democracy. Right now, freedom of speech is in some danger, but somehow I think our malaise goes much deeper. We don't have an active opposition party. We don't have a press that's willing to state the obvious. You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat. You just have to have your eyes open to see that the war on Iraq, whatever people thought about weapons of mass destruction, wasn't really its response to terrorism. And yet our leaders, by say our leaders, the opposition leaders, the press, didn't say it. What's freedom of speech, I think, wasn't the problem.
Well, I mean, freedom of speech in a formal sense maybe wasn't the problem, but the kind of thing that Jeff Stone was talking about at the very end were the problem, I think. People that are kind of, let's call it sheep-like in some ways, willing to accept what their leaders say, an opposition party, as you say, that was positioning and posturing rather than arguing for principle, right? A governing party that was hell-bent on a certain policy and was willing to take whatever means necessary to persuade or sway the people to go along with that. I mean, and then a press that, you're right, it was totally cowed, a totally cowed press. So it's a mess, and there's lots of blame to go around, it seems to me. But this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog, therefore I listen to Philosophy Talk. www.theblog.philosophytalk.org. John, that drumming can be only one thing.
Ken, that drumming is conundrumming, so pick up the phone.
Lydia, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello.
So where are you calling from, Lydia?
I'm calling from Berkeley.
Berkeley, what a great place with that great university.
So what do you do over there in Berkeley?
I'm a library assistant and a part-time teacher.
So why don't you tell us your conundrum, Lydia?
Well, I come from a large family, and one of my sisters has been promising to come visit for a long time. So the last time I talked with her, I said, well, when are you going to come out to California and visit me? And she said, you know, I really am longing to see the San Francisco Bay Area and spend more time with you, but there's one thing that holds me back, and that is, you know, the Bay Area has kind of a reputation politically. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, they're so liberal there or something. And I said, well, yes, but they're very tolerant of people who are different. And she said, yes, I've heard that, but there's one thing that they're not tolerant of, and that is intolerance. And I was a little taken aback and didn't know how to answer her.
She's self-described intolerant?
Well, she's a self-described neocon.
Oh, a self-described neocon.
Okay, but
a lot of neocons in the Bay Area. Bring her over to Stanford and let her hang around the Hoover Institute.
Well, but okay, now she's a neocon and she's intolerant of diverging views. Is that the idea?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Now, help me map this out. She's worried that we, the people in the Bay Area, are intolerant liberals, right?
Intolerant of intolerance.
They're intolerant. So she's intolerant herself, and she wants her intolerance to be tolerated, but she's afraid that her intolerance will not be tolerated. That's a mouthful. Is that kind of it?
I think there's something wrong with her reasoning, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it.
So, are you trying to talk her out of this intolerance, or are you trying to convince her that we're tolerant even of intolerance?
I'm not sure. I just wanted a good answer for her.
Now, let's see if we can unravel this here. John, is tolerance always a virtue?
Tolerance means that you don't react strongly, don't react negatively. First, it means you allow people to voice their views, and you take them seriously, or at least pretend to. You don't put them down. You don't treat them differently because they have political or religious views divergent from you. Now, if you're tolerant, I guess, are you committed to being intolerant of intolerance, or will you tolerate it too?
Let's think a little bit more. So if I'm tolerant, that doesn't mean that I accept whatever anybody says is true. I accept their right to believe it or argue it. But I don't have to accept their beliefs. I don't have to accept their arguments. I can offer them arguments against their arguments. I can say, you know what? You have a right to believe that, but it's false. You shouldn't believe it. I mean, you have a kind of moral right to believe it, but you shouldn't believe it because here's an argument against it. I mean, tolerance doesn't mean that we never challenge people who have opposing views.
You could be tolerant without being a witness. There's this famous saying, I may disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. My own version of that would be, I may disagree with what you say, but I'll donate, up to $50 to the ACLU to defend your right to say it.
Yeah, but now it's, so we say tolerance is a kind of respect for the right to others to form their own views, offer their own arguments, but it's possible to argue against them even when you respect them. Now, what's intolerance then? Intolerance is what? When you don't respect the right of other people to hold their own views or have their own arguments, right?
Now, there's two senses of tolerate here that might be relevant, right? One sense of tolerate is to let happen, and the other sense of tolerate is more what we've been thinking about, to consider the view, be willing to rationally arguing against it. It seems to me that tolerant people shouldn't tolerate intolerant people in the sense of letting them shut other people up, but they should tolerate intolerant people in the sense of hearing what their reasons are for intolerance.
Right, right. So I think in one way we in the Bay Area are tolerant. We should tolerate your sister's intolerance, but that doesn't mean we can't challenge it. I'd tell you to tell her this. If she doesn't have any arguments that can withstand kind of hard rational scrutiny by people who are dedicated to trying to knowing the truth and believing the truth and basing their beliefs on evidence, she doesn't have any arguments, then she should stay away. But if she thinks she can stand up to criticism and argument, then she should come.
You can say that the tolerant people of the Bay Area won't tolerate her shutting other people up, but they'll be glad to tolerate her expressing the view that they should be shut up.
Does that help, Lydia?
It does help.
No, I think you should tell your sister to lighten up, to defend her views. If she can defend them, she will hold them more honestly, more firmly. They won't just be sort of fixed ideas that she's afraid to put into question. You be like that too. You don't want your beliefs to be fixed ideas that you won't question. So you both be willing to argue back and forth with each other.
Tell her if she comes out here, she can have some real Dungeness crab and not those little imitation crabs they have back east.
Plus, she can hear philosophy talk.
Sounds like good advice.
Okay, Lydia.
Thanks, Lydia.
All right.
Thanks
for joining. It's been a real thrill talking to you guys.
Okay, bye-bye. Keep on listening. If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at nights, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujin Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.